This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In 1994, the United States hosted the World Cup. It was great fun, coast to coast, especially for a fledgling public radio sports program. One of my favorite stories to emerge during the 94 World Cup involved a real team that failed to qualify for the event and its imaginary counterpart. As the days of my tenure with the Only a Game squad dwindled down, I thought it might be fun to reconnect with one of the people at the center of that story, producer Richard Wilson, then employed by the BBC's Light Entertainment Division. The idea came to him in November of 1993.
I was watching the qualifying game.
Of course he was. Richard's a soccer fan, and this particular qualifier saw England playing away against unimpressive San Marino, with England in danger of failing to book a summer trip to the U.S.
They had to beat San Marino by 7 clear goals and hope that Holland didn't win. And I was watching it with lots of people in a pub, and San Marino had never scored an international goal, and they scored against England in the first 20 seconds. And everyone in the pub just burst out laughing. I mean, England did go on to score 7 goals, but because they'd let this one in the first minute, they didn't go through. But everyone in the pub was just laughing about it.
Richard Wilson must have heard the pain beneath that laughter. How else to account for his near instant recognition that absent a team for which to cheer, dismayed soccer fans in England would need a reason to smile. Thus was born the radio drama Wilson and his team of writers called Route 1 USA.
It was like being paid to make a model aeroplane or something like that. It was great fun.
The premise of the radio drama was that mere days before World Cup 94 was to begin, FIFA mysteriously decided to add one more group of four to the tournament. Group G would consist of Australia, Wales, France, and England. In a mad flurry of astonishing creativity, England's Football Association arranged for one of the elements essential to any nation's World Cup campaign, a mascot. Early in Route 1 USA, presenter Jeremy Nicholas interviews the man responsible for that element.
Simon, tell me exactly, how did Mr. Goal come about?
The FA got in touch last Friday night, and I sketched out a few rough sketches, and the one they went for was Mr. Goal.
He's a sort of humanised football with a smiley face and goalpost arms and legs.
After that, it was, you know, comparatively easy to come up with his wife, Mrs. Goal. And then, especially for the kids, the Goal's pet bulldog, Penalty Spot.
Come on though, Simon, I mean the names, Mr. Goal, Mrs. Goal.
It's a bit impersonal, I know, but I was working very quickly. I mean, they're just wasn't time to think of their first names.
Really?
The sudden, unexpected opportunity to compete in the World Cup called for a theme song as well.
T for England, F for 94, G for Glad, L for Long Ball, Legs and Linesman, A-N-D spells and...
E for England, N for 94, G for Grand, unless they just said Gland, L for Long Ball, Legs and Linesman, A and D spells and brilliant, as well as alphabetically correct.
You win the respect and admiration of your supporters throughout the L-A-M-D land.
I like that line, to win the respect and admiration of your supporters, and the fact that they can't remember it. I thought that was a nice touch.
Nice touch. Flawless, but not, as it turned out, immediately inspirational, at least for the fictional England in their first game, which resulted in victory for the opposition from down under.
But there's the final whistle. And the Australian fans delighted. Inflatable sheep mascots held aloft in triumph. It's the worst possible start imaginable for England.
Really? Inflatable sheep mascots held aloft in triumph?
It does feel like a slightly old joke to be levelling at the Australians. Even in 94, it's a bit of an old joke. I think the reason we chose the Australians and the Welsh and the French to be in the group is that it's very easy to make jokes about all of those.
Against all odds, Richard Wilson's lads would not only prevail in Group G, they would make it all the way to the final, providing their fans with every reason to hope their team would win the cup for the first time since 1966. But would that have worked as comedy?
I think England had to be ultimately thwarted. And the fact that it was in California gave us the perfect excuse, really.
Joining us is our commentator in Los Angeles, Steve May. Steve, has extra time started yet?
Far from it, I'm afraid, Jeremy. We've just had an earth tremor here. No one injured as far as I know, but there is a risk of structural damage, and I have to tell you that this match has been abandoned. The 1994 World Cup final, English football's crowning moment, ends in chaos.
Well, of course it does. And then the English players learn their visas have expired, so playing 2 days later in a rescheduled game will be impossible for them. The fictional final will involve two teams whose managers have been more careful with their paperwork, Germany and Brazil. And if fans of the real English team were disappointed over again, at least they weren't surprised. 24 years after chaos sidetracked the end of the World Cup he'd imagined for the fun of it, I asked Richard Wilson if there was anything about the radio drama and its inspiring theme that he wished had gone differently.
Now, you know, there'd be a chance of some kind of viral pickup on it. There weren't many avenues for getting the song out because we did a full 3-minute song with the verse and chorus and things. And it would have been nice to get that out. As England songs go, it wasn't bad at all.
It certainly was not.
Kingdom's crest upon my chest. I'm gonna get out there and play my best.
Stirring, at worst, at least in the World Cup as imagined by the BBC's Light Entertainment Division, England did make it all the way to the final. And this time around, in Russia, the number of teams in the tournament have increased, and England finds itself in, wait for it, Group G.
Yeah.
Whether England will, in fact, manage to win the respect and admiration of their supporters by winning the Cup this summer remains to be seen. But Richard Wilson, who has gone on to work in television, is delighted that his 1994 creation is remembered, at least by us.
It was a really enjoyable thing to make. I kind of look on it as one of the best things I made when I worked in radio.
Me too. It's time for three stories you should know. In May, the Supreme Court paved the way for sports betting throughout the U.S., and Pennsylvania is one state moving toward getting in on the action. But for our listeners in the Keystone State who want to bet on the local college teams, don't get too excited yet. That's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by MLB national correspondent Will Leach, also the host of Sports Illustrated's The Will Leach Show via Skype, and by Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello, sir.
Thanks, Bill. Great to be here.
The president of Penn State University, Eric Barron, has written the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board to ask the board to ban people in Pennsylvania from betting on games involving colleges in that state for at least a couple of years. President Barron suggests that the university needs to prepare athletes and coaches for the risks associated with sports gambling. He says he wants to protect our students, our student athletes, and our coaches, and preserve the integrity of our colleges and universities and their associated athletic programs. If the Gaming Control Board goes along with this request, folks who want to bet on Penn State in Pennsylvania aren't going to have that opportunity. They're going to have to go to New Jersey to place their wagers, I guess. And I'm not sure how that's going to preserve anybody's integrity or avoid any potential risks. President Barron also wrote in his letter to the Gaming Control Board that the university may want to lobby for, quote, an integrity fee, which I assume would result from a tax on gamblers. Does it seem to anybody else that President Barron is basically saying, yeah, go ahead and bet on our guys, but not until we get a cut?
Yeah, I'll say it does sound like that. And if I find it a little disturbing, by the way, that the notion that basically what he's saying is like, we need a little time for our players to get used to the fact that gambling is in the world. it's concerning, right? Like, I know that we're all in a pretending like, oh, wow, well, now that this gambling thing is legal, I should look into this and find out what it's all about. Like, it's a little concerning that this was not on the agenda beforehand. And I think it's clearly just a way to leverage this integrity fee. This is a big thing. Baseball's commissioner, Rob Manfred, has been a big thing about trying to be more involved into this process. They're open to it, but as long as they kind of get their vig, and I think Penn State is actually trying to be a part of that now as well.
Charlotte, is this your take on the matter as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of like, have you guys heard of the internet? you know, like you
can... I'm told gambling goes on there. I'm not shocked.
Right. I think that it's also just another level of kind of gross when you think about college athletics and the NCAA in general, where these athletes are not getting paid. They're giving, in some cases, a lot of their lives and their brains, if you play football, to this sport and to a university, and most of them aren't going to go pro. Most of them aren't going to make money on it.
Right.
And then you have the college saying, well, yeah, sure, you can bet on this, but give us a second to just make even more money off of our players. It just, there are all these levels of kind of ugh, that go along with it, and I think this is one more example of that.
I guess the only redeeming possibility here is having asked for 2 years, a sort of moratorium on gambling in-state on Pennsylvania teams, maybe they need 2 years to figure out how much to pay the players to make them a little less susceptible to bribes when the time comes for people to bet in the actual stadium when Penn State games are going on. I don't know.
Dream on, yeah. Bill.
Dream on.
Yeah, that sounds like the plan. Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah,
that's...
Charlotte, what's on your mind?
So it's the World Cup, which makes the doldrums of summer sports a little bit more exciting. No offense to baseball. Sorry, Will. One thing that I've noticed that has brought me some joy is the amount of own goals that have been scored so far. Morocco lost to Iran on a devastating own goal, and then Mexico scored one against Sweden. Well, scored on themselves against Sweden. And I feel like it is truly the most relatable play in all of sports, because how many of us haven't totally just messed up and it's been completely our fault, and you just have to look at the people in your life and be like, yeah, man, I scored on myself. When athletes who are so good at what they do, who are mentally tough, and then every once in a while they just massively mess up, it sort of gives me hope that maybe we're not all quite as far behind as we might think we are.
I get it. I tell you, there have been many times in my life. I don't have any tattoos, Bill, because, you know, the body is a temple. But if I did have any tattoos, own goal would be pretty much to sum up a large part of my life. Yeah, it is kind of a beautiful thing. Own goals happen all the time in soccer. But there's something special about an own goal that happens with literally the entire planet watching. Like, that feels – I think own goals in the World Cup should maybe count as minus two goals.
Of course I wish – that all goals could be beautiful, shots from distance, bicycle kicks in front of the goal, whatever. But the own goal is something that makes soccer intriguing. It's a very quirky game, and it also reminds me of what my kids' coaches used to say when they were playing soccer as children. He would say, kick the ball into the middle in front of the goal. All kinds of good things can happen. And he was right, no question about it. Charlotte, you can wrap this up for us, maybe.
Yeah, I think that it's also tragic, but maybe that's part of what I love about it. I think that someone once told me if I had a memoir, it would be titled "I Did This to Myself: The Charlotte Wilder Story." So, maybe I'm just it really resonates with me on a personal level. But I think that the further along you get, the less beautiful it becomes because it's just so heartbreaking. But in the early stages, I do think there's something we can appreciate about a good old fashioned own goal.
Will, your turn.
So this week, ESPN the magazine came out with this annual body issue. It's actually a wonderful essay by Roxane Gay starting off. And basically, for those of you who don't remember, the body issue is basically great athletes from across the sports spectrum naked. They're totally nude. They're totally nude. Athletes basically doing what we have been doing on weekly public radio sports shows for decades now, or at least Bill has.
Oh, secret's out. They're on to me.
I know you were waiting for your last show to say this, Bill, but I kind of scooped everyone. But I actually kind of love the body issue for a couple of reasons. One, all of a sudden, people that won't give an interview all year are like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll be totally nude for you. And the reason for that is because every single moment that athletes are not playing, they are lifting weights, they are working out, they are pushing their body to the absolute extreme. This is an opportunity for them to actually show it off. It's better than, I will step carefully here because both Charlotte and I do work for Sports Illustrated, and I love Sports Illustrated and love the work that they do. But if you're going to put the body issue against the swimsuit issue, I think it's hard to argue how much more positive the body issue is. There are men athletes, there are women athletes, there are big athletes, there are little athletes, there are from every single sport. So I love the body issue.
It really does lay bare, as it were, the work that these people put in to be on the field, to be on the court, to be doing what you do day after day, and putting your body through an incredible amount of stress to entertain people, essentially, you know, and to sort of live and die and have your career depend solely on your physical capabilities is staggering to me, and something that I think in the churn of the drama of sports, of the gossip, of the analysis, sometimes does get lost. And I think that this issue is really cool because you see it, you know, it's all there. And I always just marvel at it, and it makes me appreciate what these people are capable of. And I also just like seeing who they choose. You know, it's kind of fun to click through and be like, ooh, this person. Or like, you know, I liked that they had Jesse Diggins, for example, a cross-country skier, which is a sport that, you know, barely gets covered except during the Olympics. And even then, not that much. So it kind of gives visibility to other sports, too, that might not get as much mainstream coverage.
I think what I'm going to do is limit my comments to a question. Is there an athlete for this issue that you wish somebody had chosen or that you wish somebody had left out?
I feel bad we've not been able to get my personal schedule together with the ESPN photographers, but eventually.
You're an athlete, Will?
Let's go with sure. Yes, let's go with sure. So, but yeah, I for me, the fun of the issue is that you never know what kind of athlete you're going to get. But what the one thing that all the athletes have in common is the pride of what they're doing. And I think it's the exciting thing to see. I do feel bad that I scooped your big revelation in the last show. The fact that you've been doing the show nude since you started, that was not my story to tell. That was your story.
Yeah. Well, you know, if that were true, how long do you think we could have held on to a technical director?
I think, Bill, you're the only one that can answer that question.
Yeah, well, all I can tell you is I just cracked up the technical director. So, you know, make of that what you like, radio audience. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been MLB national correspondent Will Leach and Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you as always, sir.
Always a pleasure, Bill.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
July 2016, a woman calls 911.
We got that emergency.
She sees a man who she says looks mentally ill, and she says she thinks he's got a gun, or at least something shaped like a gun. The police come, they shoot, but they shoot the wrong guy. Hear what happened on the Embedded podcast.
I'm Bill Littlefield. In 2011, Bob Bradley moved to Cairo. He's an American, the former coach of the U.S. national team, and he'd been hired in an attempt to get the Egypt side to the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, ending what many people see as a curse over Egyptian soccer. But the timing was awful. Alex Atak has the story.
The Egyptian revolution in Tahrir Square broke out earlier that year, and the Egyptian Football League was only played intermittently. But Bob Bradley carried on his job. He selected a team and kept his players fit by pulling together international friendly games.
Things were going pretty much well until 2012.
This is Hatem Meher, a Cairo-based sports reporter who's been covering football in Egypt for over a decade.
But things dramatically changed after the 2012 disaster in Port Said.
On February 1st, 2012, Al Masry, the Egyptian Premier League team in Port Said, hosted Al Ahly, a team from Cairo.
Traditionally, the fans of Port Said do not like Cairo and do not like Al Ahly because they always believe the club is getting special treatment from authorities because it's the most popular club in Egypt. So we had football-related problems even before the revolution, but the difference was that before the revolution, security was very strict. So it was very difficult for the fans to get in any fights.
It's important to mention here that when Hatem talks about fans, he's talking about a group of hardcore fans known as ultras. It's common for ultra groups to be involved in physical clashes or insulting chants at matches, and rivalries are often drawn along political or religious lines.
After the final whistle, fans of Al Masry just were allowed to pour onto the pitch and to the opposite stands where Ahli fans were standing.
The fans clashed on the pitch. Al Ahli fans were beaten and stabbed as the cameras kept rolling. The stadium doors, which people were trying to escape through, were locked from the outside. 74 people died at Port Said that night.
Many of the more than 70 Ahli fans who died because of a stampede, and others were thrown from high from the stands. It was an unforgettable night. I went to the railway station right after the game to wait for the returning fans who returned with the corpses of their friends. This was a very sad day, and one I would like to forget, although it's very difficult.
It was one of the most tragic events in recent footballing history, and a night that changed the way a lot of players and fans felt about the game.
I personally know many Ahli fans who abandoned football altogether after the Port Said disaster. They said, if people are dying because of football, then it's not worth it. Doing sports coverage at the time, for me, sometimes I thought it was irrelevant. I personally thought I should switch to any other field in journalism because people no longer cared, and because I emotionally was greatly affected by what happened in Port Said.
Premier League games were cancelled indefinitely, and some members of the national team retired altogether.
There was no football in Egypt, and actually, nobody cared. Egypt was approaching a World Cup qualifying campaign amid little interest in the team, and little interest in football in general.
Over the next year, Bob Bradley put together a team for the World Cup qualifiers. It wasn't easy, but he did it, and they did pretty well. They were actually unbeaten in their group. With a win over Ghana, Egypt would be heading to the 2014 World Cup. And as the team inched closer to qualifying, fans started coming back to the sport. They wanted to see their side play in Brazil.
That was a dream for many, because many people were not even born when Egypt played at the last World Cup in 1990. So the build-up to the Ghana game was filled with social media comments and people even in the streets and in cafes speaking about the Egyptian national team for the first time.
Egypt lost that game 6-1. But the loss didn't do anything to diminish the renewed sense of interest in the game. Enthusiasm for football was back, and it carried over into the next qualifying round for the 2018 World Cup. Egypt were seeded in a good group, but by their second to last game, they weren't confirmed to qualify. It was against Congo, and it was their best chance of reaching the finals. If Egypt won, they'd be headed to the World Cup in Russia. If not, they'd have to face Ghana again. Roughly 75,000 people showed up to watch the game at the Borj El Arab Stadium in Alexandria. People all around the country were watching from cafes and living rooms. It was a huge occasion. The game remained scoreless for the first 60 minutes. Then Mohamed Salah, an Egyptian who plays for Liverpool, got the ball.
They thought it was over. He scored, I think, in the 63rd minute or something. So people expected that this would be enough for an easy win, but that was not meant to be. As usual, Egypt always gives its fans a heartbreak, and that happened when they equalized.
Haram, 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 haram.
Congo scored in the 86th minute with just 4 minutes of gameplay left. You can hear the disappointment in the commentator's voice. The cameras cut to shots of Egypt fans holding their heads. It looked like their World Cup hopes had been pulled out from underneath them at the very last minute.
After they equalized, a hopeful long ball was sent to the area and Mahmoud Trezeguet was hauled down, and out of nowhere, the referee points to the spot.
Egypt was awarded a penalty kick. Salah would take the shot, and the stadium erupted. Egypt had been given one last-ditch opportunity to secure their place in the World Cup.
I think this is one of the most happy moments in the history of Egyptian football. Even before he took the penalty, I liked what Liverpool coach Jürgen Klopp said when he said it's the first time for him to see people celebrating a penalty as if it has already been scored.
After the furore subsided, Salah placed the ball down on the spot and took a minute to compose himself. Egypt fans looked down with clenched teeth. their hands clasped over their eyes.
I actually did not watch the penalty itself. I could not. I prefer not to watch it and just wait for the reaction of the people to know whether it has been scored.
The referee's whistle blew. Salah stepped towards the ball and struck right while the goalkeeper dived left.
Allah! Allah!
A wall of noise erupted from the crowd, and the Egypt team chased Salah in celebration. Cameramen, coaches, substitutes, they all ran onto the pitch and mobbed Salah. Technically, the game wasn't over yet, but it might as well have been.
Personally, it was also the happiest moment in my entire life, not just in football, the best moment of my life.
Could you describe, as you remember it, the scene in Cairo after that match?
Yeah, there were wild celebrations all over the city. I roamed the streets of Cairo after the game. I went to Tahrir Square, and that was, for me, was a very emotional sign because it was the first time I see any scene of celebration in Tahrir in years. There have been severe restrictions on protests in Tahrir in the past 5 or 6 years. It was the only time that all people with different, very different affiliations gathering together in the iconic Tahrir Square to celebrate a football achievement. And celebrations went all over the night.
Egypt had done it. For the first time since 1990, for the first time in the young generation's lifetime, they'd qualified for the World Cup. Not only that, but they also had Mohamed Salah. Things were looking hopeful. But a few months later, during the Champions League final, Salah's club Liverpool faced Real Madrid. It was May 26th, just a few weeks before the World Cup was due to start. And 26 minutes into the game, Real Madrid's Sergio Ramos pulled Salah down onto his left shoulder and he had to be taken off. If it was a dislocated shoulder, he'd almost definitely miss the World Cup. As the cameras followed him towards the locker room, he had tears in his eyes.
Many people just put their hands on their faces because they feared the worst. When Salah limped off with tears in his eyes, for many people that was an indication that it was a very serious injury. People literally were refreshing their web pages and for every 5 seconds. Just to see any updates on Salah's injury. The fear that engulfed people at the time was great because they felt that Egypt would not make anything in the World Cup if Salah did not make it.
2 weeks ago, in Egypt's first game against Uruguay, Salah was on the bench because of his injured shoulder. Egypt lost 1-0. And in their next game against Russia, they lost by an even bigger margin. With Salah back in the starting 11, they lost 3-1, which left them with no chance of advancing to the next round.
People were very angry because they thought we could have done much better in the game because it was a manner that many people considered humiliating to lose to concede 3 goals in that way.
Egypt's first World Cup campaign in nearly 30 years ended when the referee blew his final whistle that evening. But it wasn't a total disaster. In the 73rd minute, with his team 3-0 down, Salah was awarded a penalty.
Penalty, and I think that's right. It was in.
Of course, he scored, and it was Egypt's first goal in the World Cup since 1990.
For many, that was a consolation that we needed because in Egypt, we had a player at the 1990 World Cup. I'm not sure if you heard about him. He's called Magdi Abdelghani, who scored our only goal at the 1990 World Cup against Holland. Since then, Magdi Abdelghani, this player, has been bragging about the goal he scored. He always speaks about how great he was because he was the only player to score at the 1990 World Cup. So it became like a joke in Egypt. When we qualified for the World Cup, Salah was interviewed by an Egyptian channel and he said, when I score, I would dedicate my goal to Magdi Abdelghani to finally silence him.
I asked Hatem if Salah scoring that goal was at least any kind of consolation. If, in some way, Egypt fans could be proud that they didn't come home from the World Cup completely empty-handed.
Surprisingly, they are very, very disappointed. Expectations notably rose over the past few months, especially at a time when we are having very difficult economic problems. Recently, we have seen inflation hitting highs, and there were recent economic measures, austerity measures, that made the lives of people much harder. So for many, that was a great opportunity to have something to cheer about. that was the thing many people spoke about. They said we were finally ready to be happy about something, and that even that our dream was shattered. Hopefully, at least we ended our curse, so we can have a chance after 4 years.
On Monday, Egypt lost their last game against Saudi Arabia 2-1. Mohamed Salah, the biggest talking point of the Egypt team this year, scored his second goal of the tournament. But after the goal, he didn't kneel to the ground in his now famous celebration. He just turned, unsmiling, as his teammates ran to congratulate him. This moment seemed to reflect the mood surrounding Egypt's unceremonious exit from the tournament. Instead of the World Cup their fans had hoped for, they'll go home with 0 wins under their belt, amidst rumours that Salah will retire from international football.
That story came to us from Alex Atak. He's a reporter and producer for Kerning Cultures, a podcast that tells stories about the Middle East. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Tina Kopnik graduated from high school in the late 70s, but when she visits her small Iowa hometown, she's still recognized.
They'll say, oh, I remember when you played basketball, or I'll remember, you know, the team that da-da-da-da-da, you know, it's just like, okay, thanks.
Just ahead on Only a Game, a look back on the days when girls' basketball was queen in Iowa. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Next week on Only a Game, the story of a murderous dictator who promised a pro hockey team a lot of money to advertise his book on its uniforms. Certain to end well, right? But now it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The World Cup is in its round of 16. Now that Iceland is out, have you a favorite side going forward?
I am the curse of death because when I lost Iceland, I started to like Senegal. They didn't make it. I like Nigeria. They didn't make it. So bear with me in Brussels, folks. I really kind of like Belgium at this point.
Okay. That's good because I don't, and now you've cursed them.
Oh, excellent.
Before World Cup 2018 began, Germany, the defending champion, was among the favorites to win the tournament, and then they came up against mighty Mexico and Super South Korea or something like that. Were you surprised at the rejoicing by so many nations after Germany failed to make it out of their group?
Well, I mean, you know, this hasn't been... No, I've got 8 jokes. I can't use any of them. Ask me that. Anyway... That was the most moving part of the World Cup to me, was South Korea winning that game with absolutely nothing on the line. Just the idea that they could beat the defending World Cup champions.
And they did so.
And that's a remarkable streak that nobody has repeated as World Cup champions in, what, 40 years?
Something like that. It's a very difficult thing to do, despite the fact they're 4 years between tournaments.
Exactly.
You'd think that any curse would dissipate in that over that length of time. Senegal, as you have pointed out, is another team that did not make it out of group play, though they had the same record as Japan, which did advance. Are you okay with the rule that says Japan goes forward because they had fewer yellow cards than Senegal? Because this is the first time that that new tiebreaker rule has been invoked.
That's such a heartbreaking way not to advance. I guess they have to have, you know, 8 and 9 levels of tiebreakers, and sooner or later you can't do anything with goals, so you have to have some other metric. But, boy, I really felt bad for Senegal.
In soccer news much closer to home, Wayne Rooney is playing for United again, and he says he's very excited about taking the field, quote, in a United shirt. He does understand it's not Manchester United this time, but D.C. United that he'll be playing for, right?
Well, I think the large white marble buildings will tip him off at some point. But this is a good grab for the league, and Wayne Rooney is one of those guys from international soccer that even I know about, so...
The NBA announced its award recipients this week, Charlie. You okay with Ben Simmons of the 76ers as Rookie of the Year and James Harden of the Rockets as MVP?
Yeah, it's really too bad for Donovan Mitchell of the Jazz, because Ben Simmons, this was Ben Simmons' second year in the league, except he didn't play because he was injured. But the one that's, of course, the greatest is Dwayne Casey of the Toronto Raptors, who got fired and then won Coach of the Year.
Yeah, doesn't happen often.
Who has landed in Detroit, which means he doesn't have to move very far.
Right.
Which is great. He's going to have to do a little work with the exchange rate. But the Pistons are going to be very good in a couple of years because Dwayne Casey's a heck of a coach.
But on opening night in Detroit, does he get, you know, the trophy?
Oh, I'm sure he already has. I'm sure he already has it. Maybe he's asking them to scratch off the name of the team.
The WNBA's Phoenix Mercury has established a new family room inside Talking Stick Resort Arena, where they play. And it's so great.
Excuse me, give me that arena name again.
Talking Stick Resort Arena. And it's so great that one of the Mercury players, Dewana Bonner, says that her twin girls cry when they have to leave the playroom after games to go home. It sounds like a pretty good place for a young mom to work.
Well, it's good for the Mercury, first of all, because this is enormously thoughtful, and I'm sure it's a tremendous appeal for free agents. At the same time, maybe you don't want to make it quite as much fun.
It's too good.
You're giving these moms, you know, these moms have just played basketball. They're exhausted. They want to get home. And you've set up this, you know, tantrum temptation when they take their kids home.
For those who hope that the U.S. would excel in the Basketball World Cup.
Oops.
Yes, there is such a thing. Not so fast. The U.S. lost to Mexico in qualifying on Thursday. Time for hoopsters around this country to panic?
Yes, Jeff Van Gundy is coaching this team, which I didn't realize. And he took the responsibility for the loss. Mexico came out and led 18-0 and held the United States scoreless for almost 6 minutes. It's an extraordinarily young American team, so we shall see.
Play at Wimbledon begins on Monday. The tournament had to break with precedent in order to seed Serena Williams, who didn't play last year because she was pregnant. She's won 23 Grand Slam titles. This can't have been a tough call.
No, it isn't. And there's going to be some complaining about it. But you know what? Like you said, when you've got 23 of the big trophies in the bank, people will do you favors.
And finally, a touring car race in Portugal featured a spectacular wreck in which all the cars were damaged. 7 of them were destroyed. No drivers seriously injured, which is amazing.
Which makes us able to laugh at the video, which is fabulous.
The race was restarted over 2 hours later. I gotta just recommend this video to anybody who has ever wondered how badly a car race can go.
Yeah, this is the FIA World Touring Car Cup. One of the interesting things about this particular circuit is that there's a video camera in every car.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got, I don't know, 50 different videos of this incredible automobile wreck.
All of them bad.
And right at the front, two cars hit each other and then wound up nose to nose across the, I guess it's a street, really. And nothing else could get by, so everybody else just hit everybody else. There are tires in the air. There are cars spinning around.
There are cars in the air.
I mean, I remember what the old wide world of sports used to do something called figure eight racing from Islip, Long Island, where the cars would literally race in a figure eight, and pretty soon some of the cars would get too slow and get T-boned at the intersection. I think there may be a place for this to bring it back now.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Do me a favor and consider leaving a review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening right now. We'd be grateful. These days, girls' high school basketball in Iowa is similar to high school basketball in every other state, but that wasn't always the case. This next story is about a time when girls' basketball was queen in Iowa and the unexpected factor that helped bring it down. Virginia Marshall has the story.
High school basketball in Iowa was it.
Tina Kopnik grew up in Ankeny, then a town of 10,000, about 10 miles from Des Moines.
We'd get 3,000 or 4,000 people in a gym, you know, on Friday, Saturday nights to watch, because in the 70s, that's what people did.
The culmination of the girls' high school basketball season was the great state tournament in March.
March 11th, 1978, Veterans Memorial Auditorium, Des Moines, Iowa. Welcome to the championship round of the Iowa High School Girls Basketball Tournament.
It was really an extravaganza. You know, at Veterans Memorial Auditorium could hold about 14,000 people, and it was packed.
And now one of the most colorful highlights, the Parade of Flags.
You know, it was a show. There was a salute to the states. It's like a pageant. They had costumes and flags, and they did this whole halftime ceremony of showcasing every state with Iowa being the last.
The best in all the land, our own 11th state, Iowa!
Tina's senior year, 1978, Ankeny beat the powerhouse Lakeview Auburn for the state title.
It was just surreal. It was a lot of joy and a lot of celebration and throughout the whole community.
Tina lives in Iowa City now. When she goes back to Ankeny, people still recognize her. They stop her on the street.
They'll say, oh, I remember when you played basketball, or I'll remember, you know, the team that da-da-da-da-da. You know, it's just like, okay, thanks.
In 1985, Tina Kopnik was inducted into the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union Hall of Fame. Her high school scoring average was zero. Tina played 6-on-6 basketball. Back then, all of Iowa's official girls' high school teams played 6-on-6. The game was invented a few years after men's basketball in the 1890s, and it was thought to be an appropriate, modified version of the game, one fit for ladies.
There's the line down the middle of the court, so the half-court line. There's three women or three girls on either side of that, and they can't cross that line.
This is Jennifer Sterling, a lecturer in the sports studies program at the University of Iowa.
So the three girls on one side are guards, the three girls on the other side are forwards, and so the forwards, all they do is shoot, and then the guards, all they do is guard the other team's forwards.
Tina was a guard, which explains her 0 point scoring average, and there were even more rules that restricted the movement of girls playing 6-on-6. They were only allowed to dribble twice before passing or shooting the ball.
You got a little extra half step. There were some rules around contact as well. You can't touch the basketball when it's in someone else's hand. So it was a less physical game and it was a less rough game.
Iowa began holding a statewide 6-on-6 tournament for its high school girls in 1920. That tournament became one of the first sporting events to be televised in 1951 and was eventually broadcast in 9 states. Basketball was so popular for Iowa girls that by 1955, 7 out of 10 girls in the state played basketball in high school. Even though most girls in the United States at the time also played 6-on-6, the game was something Iowans in particular took great pride in. But that state tournament, it wasn't about supporting female athletes, says former Ankeny player Tina Kopnik. It was about state pride.
They wanted this culminating tournament to be as, I don't want to say flashy, but certainly as entertaining as possible.
For all of Iowa's support of its state tournament, basketball was, for many decades, the only option for high school girls. Only in 1955 did the Girls' Athletic Union begin to include other sports, softball, then golf, tennis, and track and field. By the late 60s and early 70s, women across the country were starting to demand sports programs equal to those for men. Title IX, the landmark federal regulation that prohibited discrimination based on sex, became law in 1972.
I think like a lot of Title IX stories, Title IX marked the beginning of the end.
Right.
Or the beginning of the beginning, if you're looking at it from a woman's perspective.
That's Jennifer Sterling again. After Title IX, most states created programs for girls' 5-on-5 basketball, but Iowa held on to its 6-on-6 game. E. Wayne Cooley, the head of the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union for 48 years, wrote to the governor of Iowa to say that he shouldn't be worried about Title IX affecting high schools.
Because women had such equality in Iowa and such equality in sports in Iowa. It wasn't until 83 that there was a legal challenge.
That year, three Iowa girls sued the Girls Athletic Union on the basis that 6-on-6 itself was discriminatory. By then, women's college teams exclusively played 5-on-5. So girls from Iowa high schools still playing 6-on-6 were at a disadvantage when it came time to play basketball in college. After the lawsuit in 83, the athletic union let each high school decide which style of basketball they would pursue.
So I ended up playing Division III college basketball, and I don't think I did get noticed until I started playing 5-on-5 basketball.
It seemed like a no-brainer to switch to the kind of basketball that most of the rest of the country was already playing. In 1993, the athletic union finally voted to end 6-on-6 entirely. But the switch to 5-on-5 in Iowa came with some unexpected consequences. It's a Saturday afternoon in December 2017 in Solon High School's gym. The girls' basketball team scuffles beneath the basket with less than a minute on the clock. Instead of 3,000 to 4,000 fans packing the gym, only a few dozen people attend, mostly parents. The game ends. The visiting team loses 46 to 53. The crowd thins. Pizza is a dollar a slice now at the concession stand. This is what high school basketball is like in Iowa now.
I never did like it when they went to the five girl teams.
Laverna Moser is one of the very few people in the world who still plays 6-on-6. She is part of Granny League Basketball, an organization started in 2005 for women 50 and older. For Granny League players, there is a sense that something was lost when the state abandoned its 6-on-6 play.
When you watch sports on, say, KCRG Channel 9 News, and they're showing them playing a boys' basketball game or a girls' basketball game, the bleachers are practically empty. I don't even think the parents come to watch their own kids. It wasn't that way when I played in high school. The bleachers were full. When the girls played, the bleachers were full.
Nationwide, Title IX has been incredibly effective at increasing female participation in sports. But Title IX also led to a loss of something that made Iowans feel special. In 1970, 20% of all female high school athletes in the nation went to school in Iowa. 6 years later, just after Title IX, the rest of the country had started to catch up. Only 5.8% of female high school athletes were Iowan, much more in line with the state's population. Jennifer Sterling says more girls are playing sports in Iowa today. They're just not necessarily playing basketball.
Now more girls are playing volleyball. Volleyball's the most popular sport in Iowa now.
But if you're talking about the decline in enthusiasm for girls playing basketball, the lack of fans paying attention to the game, the switch away from 6-on-6 might have had something to do with it. Laverna Moser's daughter, Sherry Lind, plays on the same Granny League team as her mom. She, too, misses the six-player game.
You might think, because of the way the court's divided in that it's a slow game, but it's not slow. You know, and it's just a very exciting and unique game.
There's still a sense of pride when it comes to 6-on-6, especially for the women from small Iowa towns who played basketball in the 60s and 70s.
I went to the last state 6-on-6 state tournament. I got a button there that says I heart 6-on-6. I mean, I understand, but I love the game.
It's been 25 years since the last 6-on-6 game in Iowa. Basketball is no longer queen in the state, but neither is it the only game in town. In many ways, the story of girls' basketball in Iowa is the story of the nation, adapting to changing times, looking back, and moving forward all at once.
That story comes to us from reporter Virginia Marshall. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Gibbon. We say goodbye this week to Alex Schroeder, who produced many great stories for this show and helped me a lot with the computer because he knows more about computers than I do. Okay, low bar, but Alex, we will miss you. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.